Hi, I'm Sebastian, and this is the Happiest CEO podcast, where we speak to world-class experts about biohacking, health, business, and what it really takes to feel and perform at your best. Our philosophy is simple: success by design, happiness by choice. If you're enjoying the show, make sure you hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. Subscribing is one of the best ways to support the podcast and helps us keeping bringing you these conversations with incredible guests. And to everyone who has already subscribed and supporting the show, thank you. It means a lot. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Happiest CEO. So I'm so excited to have you here. Even more excited to have Kota here. Kota is a long-term friend who has a really interesting life that he has lived for a long time, actually. And I give you an official introduction here. So Kota Mitamura, a practitioner and educator blending over 15 years of experience in farming communities with a grounded yet mystical approach to self-understanding. He describes human design as a self-regulating system, a map of our unique energetic blueprint guiding you towards your natural authority, alignment, and individual genius. By bridging the mechanically and energetically and spiritual layers of the body graph and integrating principles of permaculture, Kota offers a practical path to more authentic living, embodied awareness, and harmonious communities. And well, welcome to be on the show, Kota.
Great to be here, Sebastian.
Yeah, I will give a little bit of a runway of like what I found exciting about interviewing you. So you are, in human design terms, someone who thinks and researches really, really deeply, in my mind. And so he would probably say because of his design, it's still not deep enough. But what I do know is that human design is something that has helped me over the years so much because it gives you pointers of how to live your life by design. When you go really deep into it and look also at designs of famous people, the ones that succeeded in life, you can see that they actually followed their design path and understood themselves and what works for them. Mm-hmm. And so I'm excited to have you here to actually dive quite deep into human design, but also, you know, the wider context of how you live. For example, you live in an area of Japan where there are 13 people in your village left, sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think the village itself is one of the oldest, oldest structural setup like that in the area. And so it's interesting how people first came into these areas, like they would find a nice aspect of facing, because it's like in Japan's northern hemisphere, so yeah. South facing, you get the sunlight, and then they actually settled from the top ridge, yeah, of that, because that's where they have access to the fresh water,
right,
and things like that. So we see the cities developing, or many cities have, you know, developed around the coastline, the flatland, because that's where the ports can be set up. But that's more like a modern way of the ports are just for the commerce, for the marketing, the market. But for people to have a lifestyle and then raise family and things like that, it's actually, they were actually on the slope, on the higher up. So that's interesting to actually have to come to understand that, even though there are fewer and fewer people remaining in those pockets,
yeah,
it's, you know, difficult to send children to schools, or, you know, there are many disadvantages nowadays to the remote,
yeah,
up higher like that. But for a lifestyle, that's amazing. If you don't have to go down the hill,
yeah,
there's everything that you can get.
Yeah. And you know, and you, it's funny that it's one of the oldest villages, but you're actually one of the youngest inhabitants there. So it's, which is not uncommon for you, Japan nowadays, right? That people go move into the cities, yeah, and the older people sort of stay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's interesting. There's always interesting dynamic happening. Like, yes, one of the oldest places, and then, you know, it's still run by old people. Probably the average age is like over 75 in the village.
That is,
but like,
unusual.
Yeah, 70 is like, yeah, considered young, because there are still people active in their 80s.
Yeah,
and then they are still part of the community activity. But for me, being in my 40s, like I'm still, and because I came from outside of that, the area, I don't know anything about how they live and then how they find things to be useful or to be more like, you know, problematic. Like they have to find something to solve in that situation.
Yeah. Always. Yeah.
And such as some
solutions to the change that they experience in those. Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's a very different framework in their lifestyle that they approach and process information.
Got it. Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about human design, and maybe let's just lay a little bit of foundation. We have had guests talking about human design before, but you know, I always love sort of like how your sort of elevator pitch is like, if you would describe human design in generic terms, and I'm really keen to then go way deeper than that, but like in generic terms, like what is human design and how is it even possible that we can sort of predict our preferences and our winning strategy as a human on Earth?
So that's the kind of question that is human design like real?
Or I guess so, right? That's where it starts.
Like, yeah, really trust, or like, even though they're like very interesting resonance that we feel when we first hear about our design, even when we first look at our body graph, we feel like, oh, there's something that's real about me or the deep being that I am, the depth that we resonate with. And one of the things that I think we can say is that human design is really based on I Ching, Chinese ancient hexagram system.
Uh-huh.
Right? So that's 64. Is the number of the sequence in ancient Chinese system of I Ching. 64. We know that's a genetic, what is that? You know, genetic code, right? The DNA.
Gotcha.
Yeah, DNA right. Code is like 64 different patterns or whatever. And that's also interesting mathematically too, because it's what the computer system is also based on, 64-bit or, you know, 128.
Yeah.
That's all just the multiplication of the, you know, 8x8 kind of thing, hexagrams.
Just move a little bit closer. To you almost have to kiss the microphone.
Actually. Oh, wow.
Let's move a little bit more.
Okay, a little bit more. Like
yeah.
This.
Yeah, yeah, you basically like you're that.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
Okay, yeah. Oh, way better. It's one of those.
All right.
Okay, cool.
Okay. Yeah. And so I think that there's a resonance to the life form, to the way that we operate as life forms on this planet, because they say it's a binary system. So I Ching is a binary system.
Yeah.
There's always yin line or yang line. And then the way that I Ching is structured is yin line or yang line. And then they stack it up to six lines. So it's like double. So trigrams double. So that becomes the hexagram.
Mm-hmm.
So we call that the I Ching symbols as hexagrams. Mm-hmm. Because there are six different stages. But each stage has either yin or yang. That's binary.
Mm.
And the combination of that is like, you know, two, it's binary, and then stacks six times. So then that gives 64 different patterns.
Yeah.
And that sounds like the very foundational principle of life form on the planet.
Uh-huh.
So, and then nowadays we are just getting into the AI or like artificial intelligence things. That's based on the computer science, which is also 64 bits and things like that. So I think that's the part that we can resonate.
Right. So we're basically saying this is something that the ancients figured out thousands of years ago, and it's still sort of the structure and the overall fabric of intelligence behind much that we are and have around us.
Yeah.
And why does that matter? Like what when you talk about the resonance, like what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, human design likes to talk about the auric field.
Okay.
or something about like a genetic continuity,
mm-hmm.
or the mutation that takes place on that level of a being.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when we work with ancient knowledge or something that's very foundational to the way that life operates, such as DNA level, which is, you know, just the frontier of the modern science, or very, very ancient, but somebody really figured out as a whole, as a system, how the change or the transformation takes place, which is what Chinese I Ching is all about.
Yeah.
Then we actually see that happening in life. So instead of making up some sort of system based on our own thinking or philosophy, if it's based on the dynamic of life, then we actually kind of get pulled into that experience,
mm-hmm.
because we always experience life as something dynamic, not mm-hmm. static. Even though we feel like, oh, this is me and this is what it is, it always changes.
Mm.
So if a system is dynamic like that, then we actually get pulled into that concept. Mm. And I think that's the same as permaculture. I think we're going to start talking about.
Yeah, right.
In reference to, yeah.
So basically saying, if you acknowledge sort of how the fundamental mechanics, if we call it mechanics, or the fundamental underlying vibration information that sits there, mm-hmm. really quite crazy to talk about in such generic terms, but like there is something underneath it. And when you talk about permaculture, it's the same. It's not, and you mentioned that earlier, you don't focus on the outcome that you want. You just basically create a foundation that is so solid that it creates an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think the terminology that can encapsulate both human design and permaculture and everything else that's happening in these times is the systems design.
Yeah.
Or system designing. So we don't plan for the outcome or the final appearance, which used to be the approach for in architecture and anything, right? So we want to make things look like this, then we design it. But systems design is like we just lay these different factors and components in the system. So we just kind of set the grid and then let it live. So when the action takes in real life, because of these parameters that we have set up in the first place, it just starts to stand up. It just starts to walk in itself.
You know, a really simple example that comes to mind is if you teach, well, if you just say like, I'm friendly to people, I'm helpful for people, I'm like, for me, I'm someone who speaks the truth, all of that. So that I would call fundamental, like, you know, what you your design. That's what you want to design yourself to be. You want to be a friendly person, you're uplifting, whatever. The result is having friends, having people you like, you, rather than saying, I want to have friends, I want to be liked. Mm. Because, I mean, the easiest way is probably like take all your savings and just give them money and you think like you will have friends. Mm. But that's not necessarily sustainable, because when your money stops, and this is just a silly example, the friends might go away because like, oh, now we don't get that anymore.
Mm.
Could make it, or, you know, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So I think mm-hmm. that's sort of like you don't focus on the outcome. You start with like what's the system that I want to be? What's mm-hmm. the system that I want to create in terms of permaculture in my garden or wherever you, right?
Exactly. So I think what you just described is how our intention draws the outcome or the result or mm-hmm. the manifestation of that intention.
Mm.
So, yeah, exactly. So that's where we can say in permaculture too, we have some intention. We have preference for the food that we want to get,
mm-hmm.
preference for a certain comfort that we want to achieve living in that environment.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't just go after like, okay, you know, just the nice light or, you know, warmer aspect, because all these things is going to shift during the course of the day.
Mm.
if it's warmer during the day, it can be too hot during the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's warmer in the winter, then the other aspect of it, like if you choose to be cooler during the summer, then it's going to be too cold during winter. So, but then we just kind of set the intention a little bit more like broad, like we want to be as comfortable as we can throughout the year living in this. So then how that go? And, you know, they just set a big rock in front of the house so that it retains the heat during the winter time, and that keeps the environment warm and things like that. So if we really set the intention of like, okay, then how do we use this factor or this component to be conducive to our intent, then we can start to design the system, design the grid. And then based on our understanding of the attribute of different factors that we can utilize, then we can just start to stack up our structure. And everything starts to just do its own, everything starts to do their own part in it. And something that we have to, so, and then something comes after that, like we have to work with whatever the outcome we get each time, and then start keep designing and keep feeding our energies and awareness back to it.
So practically, from permaculture point of view, you might want to have a path, you might want to have an entrance, you might want to have different zones with different fruit, food, and whatever, that you want some things that are really close to your kitchen and house. That's permaculture zones and stuff like that, meaning like, you know, the herbs are close to the house to sell in that. So you design it that way. And human design similarly has many different aspects. It's just not called a garden and it's not called a path, but there's so many aspects as well. And as you acknowledge that you need a path, whatever that is in human design, and you acknowledge that it's good to be, you know, really focused on this and that, you will create, I guess, a life at the end of the day that really is successful and helps you to achieve outcomes, or outcomes come because you have designed something that will create outcomes.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that you're just mentioning something that's important and interesting about human design as well as permaculture approach. And I think that's about becoming aware of something that's happening in our life. So in permaculture, we are talking about different aspects. Like if we become aware of the changes that affect during the course of the day to a particular spot on our land, based on that awareness, we can start to think about different options.
So for example, there's a shadow that comes after 3 o'clock, and therefore the patch will have some upsides for plants that don't want sun all day long, but some downside for plants that actually need it from the very beginning of the day to the end of the day, that type of thing, right?
Yeah, that kind of thing too. And then we can start to strategize, okay, like out of all these different selection of options of the plants that I can have on this land, which one can I place at this specific location because of those factors that you just described?
Yes.
And in human design, it's also like, okay, there's a definition here that I am supposed to be able to rely on according to human design system, but there's also an openness, or there's also a hanging gate, which is just a half of the entire channel that can create a definition. How can I take a look at this? And human design tells something very specific. And oftentimes they say when it's an open, or when there's only half of that definition that's there, it's very difficult for us to start to recognize or to become aware of. But because it's there already, like human design bodygraph shows that there's something there, we start to pay attention to it. And then when we do, so when we have that in awareness, we can actually see that how that operates in our life as we go through different experiences. And so having that little bit of awareness starts to create opportunities, I think, for us to learn from subtle nuances and subtle, different, like subtle level of communication that life is always offering us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that we backtrack of like where human design actually came from. But before, like, just to follow your thought process there. So simple overarching aspect of a person might be that they are, that their decision making is understood to be, it needs time. You need to feel into it, which is
that's the emotional authority.
So basically, human design, you basically put where you're born, when you were born, and where and when you were born, basically. That's all you really do, but by the minute. Mm-hmm. And it gives you back so much information about yourself, and some overarching one is like, how do you make decisions? And there's some people that can make decisions in an instant, and you might know people like that. Mm-hmm. And you can read this in the chart really easily. And then there are other people that really need to go to an emotional sort of path to get there.
Right.
And when you know that, then you can work with that. And so my AI gives me quite a bit of pointers when it looks at my meetings and how I run meetings. And it would say, don't feel pressure to make a decision in the moment, because normally you need to sleep over it, and it really works. And it feels, the funny thing is, even if I in the instant say, oh yeah, yeah, I want to say yes, but I'm not convinced. And then next day I say yes with conviction, I've sort of followed my design, and it's very different to feel I'm happy with my decision. And it's subtle. You have to be quite, I guess, body aware, but that's an aspect that's so obvious, that if you give people time and you know that their decision making needs time, things will flourish, versus they feel rushed, they feel under pressure to make a decision, and might be the same decision, but it will not feel the same emotionally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's, I think, so you were referring to the strategy aspect of human design. And that is probably one of the most interesting or even confusing aspect of it. And for some people, it's very difficult to accept that there's such a thing that a system can tell us about how we should behave, right? And how did that get derived from that? And that comes from this human design map called the body graph. And that's something that we often encounter when we first got introduced to human design. It's like we get this chart with 9 different centers configured with different channels.
Mm.
And then that looks like the chakra system, but
it does.
It actually pans out in the symmetrical. So there's left and right, instead of just centers that's aligned on the spine, in the middle.
Mm.
And human design says that's the new form of human beings. So back in those days when chakra system was more like, you know, came from India or maybe in different places, then that was it. So there's usually only 7 centers.
Mm.
But in human design, there are 9 centers.
Mm.
So like where the 2 different additions come from, we don't really know, or we don't really talk about that. But then what's clear is that the layout of the channel, of the centers, is not just in the middle lined up. It's actually opened up to left and right.
Mm.
So that's also the binary, left and right.
Mm.
And then that's like left brain, right brain.
Mm.
Right? So when we talk about right fixed or right orientation, means it's more of the emotionality. It's more of like a future oriented. It's a little bit more vague. It's more relational. And then we want to actually look into different possibilities, more like the ocean of different stories. And then we we finally come to decisions, or we finally come to realization about what that thing is about. And left fix is more of like intuition, spontaneity. And then we actually get to see like, oh, this is how it goes. And often that's based on logic, because this is something that happened before. And then if we just really exercise our logic, then it is clear that this is going to happen next. When we operate on that kind of knowledge, then we can make decisions, and we can make that decision really fast.
Mm.
Because if we know that pattern, if that happens, this one happens next, and then that another thing happens, we would follow that.
Mm.
Then we can just make those steps really fast. But when we see a lot of different possibilities out there on the right side with emotionality and relationality, then we can't make that fast decision, because different factors is going to lead to different places.
Mm.
And that's, so human design points to more of that relational, emotional realm of human experience come into play with the whole of evolution, or the way that humanity start to experience more in our life.
Mm.
So we have developed our civilization and culture so fast to this point based on the logic, right? Like we understood the patterns in a way, and we applied the patterns and then just really built it out. But then that way of doing or operating life is really going to exhaust itself at the end. Or it doesn't, it maybe, you know, not necessarily, but when we look at the resources and all these things, we are kind of like exhausting all the possibilities. So now it's time to really open up what are other possibilities out here. And really that's where we can start to integrate and take a look at what's happening as a result of having developed so far, and then what are other possibilities that we can come to, and we can, or other possibilities that we can start to consider and integrate and see how things go if we do that, if we take time like that. And I think that relates or connects us back to the system design kind of approach. We recognize that part, and we also become aware of this part. And then we just place those things as parameters in that grid, and then let it run as a real life. And something else comes up, and then we actually start to notice that at the next level, and just like, okay, as a result of my actions, these things took place. And then what's next? How, you know, where, what did I learn from it? And what are different possibilities that I can now think about? So that just kind of keeps on going like that.
I think, yeah, to tie a bow around that concept that Koda just explained, to me, like, let's say, you know, like we have normal language that would say that person is friendly, that one is more a brisk person, this is a fast talking person, this is a slow talking person. This is just our language describing a person, but it's actually fairly superficial, of course, because it's just like just observing a human one to another, and that's what often the common understanding of who we are is. Very, very simple. That's a tall person, that's a not tall person. Human design, which came through a particular person to us, and it took ancient wisdom and overlaid it with particular other concepts, basically says also, this person's like this, this person's like that. It's really hard to believe without having quite a bit of metaphysical understanding why this is accurate, and why you can just use the position of where you were born, mm-hmm. and the time you were born to actually say, this is how this person will operate. That's their design. Mm-hmm. But in the end of the day, it does work like that. And if you look at people who had successful or very unsuccessful lives, and you look at how they lived, often it actually matches exactly what their human design would prescribe to live as a winning formula, for example. Mm-hmm. And it's it's a real stretch when you come from a world where if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. Versus like, this is a very, very intelligent design, that a way of looking at a human. Actually, animals have human designs too, right?
Animals and plants, I think they have different.
Yeah. Too. But like that knowledge was uncovered, and it's so far remote from our way of looking at something, quite an unsophisticated way, versus human design being just so detailed. Mm. It is quite a jump to accept that it works. Mm. But once you're there, and once you realize it, you realize like, wow, this is a tool that is unbelievably powerful and explains basically every part of our personality.
Mm. Yeah. And another distinction of human design compared to astrology is that human design actually takes into account the information of about 3 months before the birth time.
Mm.
So the human design chart that we get comes from the information of the birth time itself. So, you know, they calculate the planetary positions and put it onto the 64 different gates, and then that gives half of that information. And then the other half of the information comes from the planetary positions about 3 months before that. And so that's a huge assumption right there. Like, why is it 3 months before?
Mm.
So that's a part of like a mystical thing. But then it seems like there's a mathematical
relationship.
Yeah, relationship to that moment. And when we are talking about the authority, like, you know, how our design or how each design can behave to really come to its full potential is based on that combination of those two information, right? So like then at that point we're like, well, but if the information from 3 months before, if that's not proven or if that's not established, how can we say that this strategy that human design suggests is valid?
Mm.
So, but I think there is a way to really work with it. Like, we can just kind of try to experiment with it. And that was, I hear, the original message of human design is like, this is how things go. Just try it out.
Mm-mm.
Because we don't really know until we try it out on our own. We can suggest, a human design can suggest that this is a behavioral protocol for your design, but we don't really know how that works until that person himself or herself does that. And that's the interesting part too, to me. It's like, yes, we can just draw so much information from the internet or from human design practitioners about what human design is like. But until we digest the information in our own way and really try to give it a try, we give it a shot, then we don't really know. That doesn't really materialize.
Mm.
And that's the same thing about, okay, like, what's real in our life and what's metaphorical, what's hypothetical. And there are different examples that I want to share about how that seems to be true in the case, like, such as a case of like twins, right? Like, if we take the example of twins, like, they probably are born apart, like 20 minutes apart or 10 minutes.
Ours is 2 minutes. Yeah.
Well, that was 2 minutes.
2 minutes difference. So yeah.
So your girls are 2 minutes difference.
Yeah.
But then if we draw a human design chart,
yeah,
there's got to be something that is just slightly different in the numbers that they calculate.
Yeah, because like the theory behind that, or you know, or the reality is that we move through space on the planet, like our planet moves through space. So the constellations that we have to the planets is slightly different. Mm-hmm. The theory behind it is basically there's a particular energy flowing through the ether, through the universe. And let's say, so don't forget your thought, but I just wanted to say why this matters, because let's say, you know, the planet like Mars, or the area of where Mars is, is at the moment not facing you. And then, you know, 2 minutes, 10 minutes later, it is facing you. Mm. The aspect that makes a difference because you're exposed to different energy. At the end of the day, everything is vibration and energy, you know, because we basically just space. Yeah. It's just not the human experience doesn't explain that well because it looks also solid.
Yeah.
But if you go back and say it like, actually, below us is energy, and which is information. Mm. That's why it matters when you were born, because it always shifts. And you know, to your point, that's why twins can be different, because they're not born and taken their first breath. I guess that's the point.
Yeah.
Because then the energy is locked in, basically.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Sorry, but you continue. I didn't want to take it away from you, but I just thought it was good to have that background.
So no moment is identically the same in this universe. And the universe loves novelty. That's what Terence McKenna said. And I think that's really, like, really profound, because that means every human being on this planet, even their twins, or even the, let's say, we can just really make assumption of, like, you know, babies born in this exactly the same moment.
Mm-hmm.
On the planet,
mm-hmm.
and they should theoretically have exactly the same human design chart. Mm-hmm. But it's really a matter of if you meet those two people in your life and have an interaction with them or not. And that's kind of like the concept of quantum physics. Unless you become aware of that phenomena, that really doesn't exist, or that doesn't really affect anything, or that doesn't change anything about life. And the same thing, I think, applies for human design. Like, if you have twins as your children, then you know that they are different.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And then the way that the human design chart would show that.
Mm.
And, you know, I've had a couple of examples of looking at the charts of the twins. And they're different signatures to them, even though like a lot of them are same, and very likely their type is the same, profile the same, also the variables, all these things the same, but there's a bit of difference in it. And when we can actually study a system like that, that could capture identical difference, you know, those are identically different, even though identical twins.
Yeah,
what makes it very intriguing about a system like this. And just like, okay, then it's not just about the birth time, the moment, but actually that moment has access to the information 3 months before, right? And then when we look at that, like, it's not just the 3 months before that kind of, like, you know, linear timeline, because when we look at different possibilities that open up every moment, the moment that we have come to at the present time is just one of those possibilities that were possible 3 months before.
Gotcha. Right, so there are possibilities as well, so there is a in a sense a random to it too.
So it's not unidirectional. Like, time is not just like linear anymore. When we think about future as different possibilities, the past was possibilities too.
Wow.
As well as the present moment.
Yes.
So when we deal with, okay, the certain birth time, one set of information from the birth time and another set of information that's going to be combined as a human design chart from 3 months before, these are two different sets of possibilities. And then when we think about you know, a moment or any moment in that way, there's infinite combinations, and it is our consciousness and awareness becoming aware of certain aspect that makes those possibilities actually manifest as a phenomena. And it seems like that's what we are doing,
you know,
every day. Like, we just, like, we are always evolving, changing, growing. But when we grow, it's it always involves the awareness becoming like, oh, this is what happened. Oh, let's say I shouldn't have done that. Or, oh, that's good, I did that. Whenever we catch ourselves on that level, then there's a shift comes. And then we choose one possibility out of so many. And that's what they refer to as, I think, the epigenetic theory too. There are so many different genes accumulated in our, from our heredity. But how do we become that? There are so many factors that people can point to, like environmental factors or like stress or anything like that. But I think on the spiritual level, on a very, to me, day-to-day level, it's about our awareness and then what we took a notice. And then, yes, to have taken action on that awareness is important too.
Mm.
But just to have a set of awareness, that's very important. And human design is, I think, basically trying to work from that level.
Got it. Yeah, yeah. And it has a lot of pointers in it. I brought up my design basically just for me actually to help seeing what the categories are that you can look into it. And it's impressive. You know, so there's, for example, one thing that is called, you know, you like what number you are. So sorry,
profile.
What's it? Yeah. Your profile. Mm-hmm. So there's seven, right? Eight.
Is it seven or 12 or more?
I mean combinations, yes.
Yeah.
But like for me, for example, my profile is called Hermit, or Hermit Opportunist, and there are certain sets of understanding of what that means.
Mm.
And the Hermit, and we can talk about this a little bit because you have so many ideas also how that matters of like how one is and the other is. So Hermit is a person who actually enjoys being alone, and that's where I get my energy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the one who goes to the party and get energized by the party. Right. There is an absolute limit for me personally, and has always been. Mm-hmm. What I found so helpful is that I remember many Christmases as a child where I would remove myself from the celebration because there were 10 people or more in the room,
mm-hmm.
because I was just overwhelmed, and I would not know why. So awareness is great because then you know, hey, this is not a bad thing. I used to feel so bad about leaving that celebration for an hour or two, going into my room playing.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened really early, like let's say it was as long as I can remember, really like 4, 6, maybe I would just be in a corner, be quiet or something like that. And that was just really my happy space to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would come back. But there was always this like, don't I love my family? Why can't I be with them for any longer and so on?
Mm-hmm.
Knowing human design, knowing that what Hermit really means, is like that it's a fundamental need of my design. And so I was aware of it before,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't really feel good. Now I'm aware of it and I accept it and this is how I live my life. There's always a space for me to retreat. That's where I do my best work.
Mm-hmm.
And I really embrace it rather than saying, oh, I really should push myself to be amongst, you know, a co-working space where, you know, like an open plan office,
mm-hmm.
which for me is as challenging as it goes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To me, it's mm-hmm. just wonderful. And, you know, whatever your profile is, it can be really helpful.
Yeah. And then that's the second line part of the Hermit is the second line keynote. And the keynote for the fourth line underneath.
Which is my opportunist.
Is the opportunist.
The yeah.
And what you're just describing as the as your childhood memory of feeling the need to retreat.
Yeah.
Was actually taking place at parties, right? So that's the background of that. So opportunists is those people who actually recognize different opportunities and different possibilities based on their social interactions with meeting with people. So there's so it's not a coincidence that you remember that realization about your need to retreat at parties, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also like being too full, you know that, you know, there's a need to have your own space and time. However, you have a big family now.
Mm.
So that's like, there's always social interactions happening. And then for you to go out there and do your work, yes, you have founded this big company, And then now you have me here. So you're always interfacing with different people.
Yes.
So, but that really feeds you, because then that makes, gives you in turn the keen sense around the need for yourself to be in your own space. And how do you maintain that dynamic? The awareness really, awareness for, you know, your, the awareness that you talked about the hermit being, the importance to be a hermit, really comes from the situation, from the background, from where you find yourself in this life. And so that's just another example of how human design is set up. It's like even in the profile, you know, one of those first interfaces that we see on the human design is really set up on that, the dynamic. What is the natural situation that the person is, and what's the natural tendency of the personality is. So that's described as design and the personality. So design side is where, in terms of the profile, it's underneath. So fourth line represents the design.
Okay, that's
human design.
Which is an opportunist, meaning through my network, I will be able to make connections. And you might actually fill in. What else would be typical for an opportunist?
Opportunists, so they're good networkers, right? They're good networkers. And then...
But not cold callers. I need to know the people I meet through another person, right? Like, you know, like I don't have much success in walking up to a stranger and connecting with them. However, what's the crazy thing, and it's a subtlety, if I have a friend who connects with this stranger because they have that ability and introduce me to them, they're not a stranger as such. It was sort of bridged by someone who knew them. It's an odd thing, but at that moment, conversation flow very differently. And so at parties, I do know, again, like, you know, you know, you go up to someone who don't know, it's quite hard for me to get it right. And it's always awkward versus, you know, someone say, hey, let me introduce you to that person. And energetically, it seems to be a complete different situation.
Right.
And I often gel much better with people there. I don't know what that is, but yes, it's noticeable.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Because so that makes me think about the first metaphorical story that's been told about Ra, the founder of human design, about different profiles, is that he said it in the metaphor of house with where the party is happening. So like the first line is a foundational, the floor, so that's where people come into the party, the house. And then they'd have, you know, they just have to meet everyone. So first line is the investigator. So they have to meet everyone, introduce themselves. And they are at that level of, okay, there's like, you know, some nervousness can take place. Like, you know, they're anxious. They may not, like, they may feel like, is this my party or what? Like, you know, am I going to actually have a good time or like meet right people? That's the first line experience of entering the party at the first floor. And then the second line is already really, you know, mingled with and found their seat and found that the people have found their company. So they've been natural, right? So they're probably already engaged in the conversation.
So that would be me, the hermit?
Yeah, that's the hermit. So, you know, sitting at the corner, being comfortable, and then don't like to be pulled out. Like to stand up. And
I just stick with the same person the whole party. That's basically me. And again, like I'm thinking, oh man, you know, like being self-talking myself, like I'm not good in this, you know, but really it's my natural to actually stick with the person for a long time at a party.
The third line that comes after is the, it's more like the adventure or the trial part. So those are the people who stand up and go get a drink at the kitchen and just meet new people. And just bump into people and just like, oh, you know, like, you know. So that's the next level of exploring, the exploration. The fourth line comes when that person actually finds that there's a second floor to the house.
So that's the opportunist.
So that's the opportunist, like taking the opportunity to go upstairs. Oh, wow, there's another different group of people here. So that involves a little bit of like, you know, starting over again. It's like going to a different party. So like, okay, you know, that's why it's harmonious to the first line. So it shares that element of having to go through that to the new entry. However, you are already at the party. So you know this is a party, and you've done that first line part of introducing yourself, meeting people, feeling comfortable and exploring, and then going up to the next level is like, okay, this is a new chapter, but then I can do it. So that's the opportunist. And then opportunist likes to externalize the foundation to that network of people that you feel comfortable with. And so the combining that element with the second one, right? So that's how we start to just raise that delineate some of these things. Like, okay, so you have that ability to apply yourself in familiar situations, familiar situations, guided by your natural ability to be comfortable with what's happening. So you're the one who can, when you're relaxed, you can just have like a really deep conversation and just really be present in the moment as a second line personality. But you're also supported by your ability to explore different opportunities when you feel comfortable like that. Or when you feel like, oh, you hear the call of like, oh, maybe it's just time for me to stand up. I don't know why. I'm not interested in exploring or putting myself into new situations. However, I just feel like I have to stand up and just go upstairs. And that's what's represented by what's described in general introduction to 2-4 profile is that they have that. They need to catch the moment when they hear the call.
You can't force it. It's like, you know, it feels good now to stand up in a party. Which is, of course, you know, there are many other situations. Like, this is the crazy thing. Once you understand it, you really see the pattern in your behavior or when it feels good and bad as well. There's that feeling element. Who is the fifth line?
So the fifth line is the one who's looking outside out of the window on the second floor.
What are they called?
So fifth line is a heretic.
Okay.
Yeah. Fifth line is a heretic. So we can think about that in resonance or in harmony to second line. Second line was somebody who was just when they were still at the first floor, they were just sitting on the corner, maybe just like sitting right next to a comfortable company. They may or may not be engaged in conversation, but they are not interested in standing up and meeting new people. They already found their spot at the party, right? Fifth line in harmony to that line, but already at the second floor, they are just, you know, maybe there are less people at the second floor of the party. So they'll be just standing in the by the window, just looking outside and like see that new people coming into the party. From outside, they can totally see that. Like somebody is on the second floor window looking down. But they can't really see who that is, right? From the bottom of the house or outside of the house. So that's what they kind of project on. They imagine who that person may be, or they just kind of imagine what's happening inside.
So you're basically saying that when these people are met by someone else, they make up a story of who they think this person is, but it's not necessarily true. So that's like, so me being not that person, people sort of get me, or they get it probably right, or have a better chance to get it right. Whereas number five, if that person is assessed by someone, it's hard to really grasp like, oh yeah, I think that's the type of personality I'm dealing with. Is that right?
And then, so there's that, the projection part is being shared, as you are saying, like as a second line personality, you get projected on, like, you know, if I...
Right, people make up what they think you are and who you are and just run with it.
Yeah.
Oh, that must be tricky.
Yeah. So like fifth line personality or fifth line on the design side as a part of the profile, they are in the position to receive that kind of projection and being able to do what they have to do with it, whether they actually have that ability or not.
Mm-hmm.
But when they can get it right, because, you know, they can speak from the second floor, they can speak to more people, right? If they can just speak with a microphone.
Right. So they're the type of person that can broadcast to a bigger group of people and can influence them, can communicate to them. And then what's sixth line?
So sixth line is supposed to be already up at the on the top of the roof of the house.
Okay.
So no longer as a part of the party, right?
Okay.
But already kind of contemplating on why, you know, the whatever the, you know, the contemplating on the party itself.
What are they called?
Oh, so sixth line is a role model.
Role model.
But role model, I think, can be a little bit vague in terms of how we actually understand what sixth line can be. Because a role model is, I think, a concept where people can actually have access to, can look up, right? But sixth line profile is not always accessible. And then in terms of human design, like there are information about people with sixth line in their profile not really being accessible in certain periods of their lifetime. And that's totally natural and fine for them. So being at the top of the roof.
What do you mean by not accessible, like in practical terms? So if a dad is like sixth line dad, what does that mean to his kids? That person is not accessible. Is that what you mean? Or
let's say so like fifth line or, you know, fourth line people, they have the social interactions happening.
Okay.
As a part of the standing in this life, but for the sixth line people, they may be like totally immersed in their own process still, or on their reflection, or whatever they do to embody their themes, their projects or their inclination. That kind of involvement, like really being immersed with whatever we do, would lead to a role model type.
So it's often seen at one stage of the light as antisocial, maybe even. Yeah, is that what you would you say?
It could be.
Could be. Yeah.
Could be antisocial, but from time to time, because I think role model people has to find their own standing, like niche or like somewhere that is really perfect for them.
Mm.
In order to get to that place, it takes a little bit of trial and error. That's why sixth line resonates with the third line, which is aware and consciously exploring.
Mm-hmm.
But sixth line is exploring or is trying to get to a place where the exploration can lead to.
Mm.
And where that can lead to, I think, is a very special place that is perfect and correct for that person individually and as a unique being. And so six is where that's actually the top of that the line structure. Mm. The next one goes back to the first.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the I Ching set up is. It's a cyclical system. So the 64 gate goes back to the first gate.
Right. Gee, it's quite complex, hey? Like all these different elements. I'm just thinking, so I thought, I love it. And that's why I wanted to introduce sort of like the deeper thinking around that. And it can be quite metaphorical rather than like really practical. I know you would have practical examples as well, but I think it's good to actually talk about the concepts in particular. Mm. So we talked about the different authority, how we make decisions. One thing I just really want to touch quickly on, because I have spoken about it before, but there are different different types in terms of you got a manifestor, which is a really particular energetic setup. But at the end of the day, I've had this experience. Manifest is normally a person that is meant to speak first, I guess. Would you phrase it that? I certainly know that I was standing with other generators, which is my type, and we were chatting happily away. A manifestor enters the circle, and everyone stopped. They didn't know that that person was a manifestor, but it was just we just stopped talking and sort of waited. And then the manifestor said something, and after that, there was a natural flow of introducing itself, and, you know, it was a normal conversation again. Mm. Anyway, a couple of hours later, we discussed it in the workshop, said, like, this person entered a circle and everyone else stopped talking. Oh. And the manifestor said, this is the story of my life. Like, I seem to interrupt conversations. Mm. And what she later on understood, and it was a big relief to her, is like her energy setup is just that people look for that person to talk first, to give some guidance. I would say you might have better words for that, but in the end of the day, if she accepted, it's just how it is. I think she would feel less bad about having that sort of disruptive energy to other types. Right. Yeah.
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 So that's a manifestor. Mm-hmm. And we have then we have the manifesting generator, projector, and reflector. Mm-hmm. These types are so tangible. To me, this is the type of categorization that you can easily see. I've kids with different makeups. Mm. It's really, really clear. Mm-hmm. Actually, let me just take my tank. Like, one more practical sort of example is a generator has a lot of energy. They can just keep going and, you know, get through a project. Manifesting generator has a burst of energy. They go harder, but not quite as long, I would say. I'm not quite as enthusiastic. That's my take on it. And then the manifesting is more like, I got this idea, do it. Mm-hmm. I got this idea, do it. And then it's more that way. Mm-hmm. Whereas the projector is like, I guess it's a reflective energy. Mm-hmm. And then the reflector itself, gee, that's a very rare type. There are actually percentages of how many people in society are who reflectors are, like 3% or is it 1%?
I think
1%. Yeah.
What I hear. Yeah.
And you have the feeling you meet yourself when you talk to them because they mimic you unknowingly, right?
Yeah, or mimic you, or mirror you.
Mirror you, right. Yeah.
And just kind of fill in the gap for you.
Mm.
And yeah, and just reflect back to you, this, you know, reflector.
Mm.
And that's more like the moon, right? The moon is what facilitates life on the planet.
Mm.
So a lot of people operate on the sun aspect of it. And then sun is like the position of the sun is important in human design too.
Mm.
And so a lot of people are just like really supported by the energy of their sun. However, for reflectors, we have to look at it from the different side of it. That's really the yin yang concept too, because yin is not weaker. It's actually yang is just more of what's the word, like, not just expressing, but it's more like
outgoing,
and then also outgoing energy, whereas yin is a condensation kind of energy. So yin is pulling all the energies from the ether and concretizing things.
Mm.
So that's a metaphor for women.
Mm.
They seem receptive.
Mm.
However, they're the one who has the energy to carry a baby and then give birth.
Mm.
And so reflector, and I think all four types work in that kind of dance. And as you are describing, there's like some characteristics that we can recognize according to the types. Then what's interesting is, just like you described too, is how these different types interact with each other.
Yeah.
And how does that work? And how were these types decided? And it's based on the body graph that we see in human design system. And the type is basically derived from which center in the body graph is defined, switched on, or switched off.
Mm.
And then when it's open, we have the yin kind of potential to it. Because when it's open, when it's not colored in, we can absorb more information associated with that center.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Sakura Center, when it's defined, it makes a generator type. And then how the Sakura Center operates is like, it's generator, so it's like a engine.
Mm.
When you turn it on, it just runs and runs and runs and runs.
People with a lot of stamina, I guess.
According to its functions. But it has to stop at night. It has to just like give it a rest, like before it overheats and exhausts itself, it has to stop.
Mm.
And that's the basic function of how the engine works. So you just turn it on in the morning, run it all day, and then gets things done.
Mm.
But at the same time, it shuts down. So that's what I feel with the generator friend of mine. It's like they know when to stop, because I'm not a generator. I don't have a Sakura Center defined in my design. So I don't know when to stop.
What's your type?
My type is manifester.
Huh.
So even though, so that goes to the next conversation, that can lead to the next conversation about manifester and projector difference, or the manifester and generator interaction. And because that's what you were saying about the story of manifester stepping into the generator conversation.
Mm.
Even though my experience was a little bit has been different.
Okay.
Like I can't really disrupt generators when they're together and doing things.
Okay.
Because they're already engaged with that activity.
Uh-huh.
And I have no place to just really insert myself. So I end up joining them, but over time, my energy seems to disrupt some of that flow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't just stop that, but I think that's another thing about how projectors and manifestors can come into the dynamic that's operating by generators.
Yeah.
Because generator is the majority type. And so in order for this world to run, many generators have to be working to keep the operation going. And projectors and manifestors, including and reflectors, are the minority type. And those three minority types do not have Sakura Center defined. So they have to participate in different ways.
Mm.
And for manifestors, somehow they have energetic expression connected to the throat center.
Mm.
For generators, they don't have to have throat center defined because they have the Sakura Center, the engine, already colored in and turned on.
Mm.
They already participate in the activity of the world through the Sakura energy. With that vibration, they can be a part of that team, part of the scene, because they communicate, they express themselves with that energy. But because manifestors don't have the Sakura Center vibing, they have to use their throat, the voice, for the expression in that communication form in order to participate in that scene. And for throat center, kind of like communication, to be effective, they have to see the right timing. Yeah, so that the timing is very important to even to disrupt things. Like if we just try to disrupt it when it's not time, it either creates a chaos or it just kind of gets repelled.
Mm-hmm.
It just bounces back.
Mm.
And then manifestors don't like that as an experience because they feel like they want to be effective and impactful.
Yeah.
But if that bounces back, it's like, I'm no use.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, one of the advices I think for manifestors is to really not to just use disruptive energy, whatever, because that's what they have or something, but really to learn the timing of how their energy can actually make that impact. And that varies from different details of each manifesto design. But then for projectors, they have certain definitions happening in their design. But first thing, they don't have the Sakura Center defined, so they don't vibe with the team in the way that Sakura generators get together. And then they don't have the energy connected to the communication center, the throw center. And that doesn't mean that the projectors don't have the throw center, the communication center defined. Some projectors do. And some projectors even have other energy centers defined. But those two are not connected to the throw center definition, and the definition of the energy centers are not connected with each other. And so what that means is that they have the ability to communicate, they have the energy to do something, but not in the context of the sakura vibration, that which is already a communication form to really come together. Or they don't do that in their own expression of, this is my energy, this is how I can disrupt and participate. And they don't communicate that. They actually communicate for the situation, for the context, for that specific case that they recognize as a potential improvement or potential. And so recognizing those things specifically in those situations or in those people is a gift of projectors. And so
something really practical with projectors is that overall, because they're considered a non-energy type even, right? Like so basically they don't have the drive, internal drive of a generator who can work on a project all day long. It is certainly some, I have heard advice to projectors saying, don't do a full-time role, rest more, be certainly a more passive sort of person. Yeah, and don't push yourself as a general would be. And that's quite a practical and really a dilemma. Like if I look at a projector, it's like, so what does that mean? Does it mean this person is not meant to work full-time or work in a different way, or is none of that true?
Yeah, mental work they can be good at, I think. And They can be really good at it because I think they are noticing a lot of things.
So really receptive personalities normally.
Yeah, I think in general, the auric field or the energetics of projector type is said to be receptive. But I know many projectors who also have different energetic centers defined, like root center defined projectors. They can have a lot of juice, and then meaning like they have a lot of physical energy to contribute. But so they can be a part of the activity with generators and everybody else. But I think one thing is like they don't need to try to keep up with that momentum that's already happening with the generator team. They can participate in it, but they can focus more on what they are taking note in that dynamic. Because that's eventually how they get to contribute, is such insight. And it's important that they recognize that, and they are being recognized for such ability and contribution that they can bring into the scene.
So when you talk about recognition, would you say if I would have a projector child, which I do, they particularly like praise. Would you say? Is that sort of more
interesting?
I mean, I certainly see that, but maybe I'm just biased, but that's sort of my
play. What do you mean? Because they're kids, they're still children, and
they all
they
like
have the work, homework.
You're right.
So that's their work.
You're right.
But the play is when it's more casual, but playing with other children and maybe adults. But I think in play there's like more like it's the rules are a little bit looser, right? Like there's a room to play, right? So like they can actually notice things like, oh, that rule, we can maybe improve this rule.
That's a projector talking normally, right? So they because they sort of have the overview of things. They have the the awareness of what they see. Crazy. All right. Well, there are a couple of other things. So, you know, you were talking split definition word, a single definition word, triple. So basically, look, all the different things we're talking about is based on an underlying map. So it's a little bit like a car is a car, no matter whether it has a four-wheel drive or whether it has not a four-wheel drive. But you can name four-wheel drive, even though it's still looking like a car. It's the same as a map. Everyone has a different map, and you could say everyone has a map. But for some people, the makeup then means you have a split definition, which means your energy runs and flows through a particular person. And the practical thing there, and correct me if I'm wrong, is if you want to feel a particular way, going is being in a space with someone else who can bridge your definition means that you function differently. So there is this interaction between different personalities as well. Very, very complex, but there's certainly, you can basically change how you feel by who you are with, right? Is that sort of, would you subscribe to that? Is that sort of an explanation of that or too loose?
Well, I think, we may say that's too specific even.
Okay.
Because that's the situation that happens to everyone.
Yes.
Meaning like when we meet and interact with other people who bring in different activations, different design, we are meeting and merging with them. And most likely those other people's designs and activations are hooked up to your activations or your open centers. So when we say that activations for split designs bridge those two separate part of the definitions, is something that's like, yeah, specifically that it's that, but that same thing of integrating with other components that don't usually belong to our design is actually universal to anyone. And when we go back to that concept of personality side and design side, you know, the two sets of those planetary positions give rise to human design information. At that level already, we are bridging two aspects of ourselves. So for split definitions too, if we have two different islands or three different, or yeah, it can be even like four different islands of definitions that are broken apart by openness, then that is the similar situation where different parts of the definitions are actually communicating with each other because it's part of that the holistic design. So even though you may have the split definition between, I think in your case, the throat and G-center definition, and then also the sacral spleen and solar plexus definition, and I think you're bridged by gate 5 and you know, gate 22 and things like that. But then that communication within your design is actually somehow taking place with or without the presence of other people.
Okay, right. So definition, right, okay. So this happens even when I'm by myself. What I found interesting too is there's one particular aspect which it's called where your sort of where your cross is, right? What do you say? Yeah. Is there an overarching title for that? What's it called? I mean, I thought it's life meaning, but you know, maybe I'm not quite right there.
Yeah. That's called incarnation cross. And I think it's like a life path.
Life path. And and what is fascinating is I have a lot of different types, like a lot of friends that I know their human design off. And when I look at their life path, it's certainly noticeable that makes sense. Like, how many different life paths are there? Many?
Yeah, there are quite many. I can't recall the number of my mind.
I mean, isn't one thing, and it rings true. So my life path is you are here to live in the moment and have your own way of doing things. You aren't meant to give direction to others, which normally I agree with. By you leading the way and doing what you are passionate about, others find your guidance helpful and will follow. And that's often, I talk to people about what I do just from the point of view of like sharing where I'm at in my life. And what happens afterwards is that people actually say, oh, I tried what you did, or I read the book that you did, or I went to the mentor that you mentioned, and so on. That seems to be the way, whereas if I say, you should do this, this, and this, and let's do this, it doesn't seem to have quite the same impact. It's when I live by example that people feel inspired. So that's how I understand this path to be. It's just like, you do your thing, you share what you're doing, and people leave it or take it.
Yeah. I think that's really the important part, is like we share what we do. And I think to find a direction and to really set that direction into the motion is what you do for yourself. And that's why you can share that aspect of insight with other people too. So it's as important to come to the realize that that's actually important for ourselves, and you know, just really, really seeing the direction of your life, and how much, as a twofold profile, how much of the time are you allowing yourself to tune in with it? And it's very like an individual, personal thing, because you're not talking about the collective direction that you know I tend to talk about, but you're talking about the direction of individuals within the collective. And then when everyone or many more people can step into that life path direction that's you know suited for them, that's good for them, then eventually everything comes together. The collective, the culture, the society will start to move towards a different level. And how that happens is like by emanating, embodying that for ourselves. So the theme of the incarnation cross is very interesting, because that's where we actually, I think that's how we become a part of humanity. We all take different roles, or we all participate in the larger, greater story of humanity, from walking on a different life path or taking on different roles within that in order to participate.
What's your incarnation cross?
It's education.
Ah, you're deeply in education.
So yeah, I like the education for my own well-being. But also, I'm probably, you know, and then also they say teaching is the best way of learning.
100%.
Yeah. So that's another aspect of it. I think for me, that's something that I haven't done as much.
Teaching.
But I know that, you know, that's my life path. So at one point, that becomes very, very important.
Going to a very different one, like when I look at the human design app that most people sort of familiar who study this stuff, you actually have a particular sleep pattern, right? Like how you actually can sleep. So my one here is, it's important for generators to use all of their energy prior to going to sleep, which I can relate to because I have a generator, manifesting generator, and a projector child. This is the key for healthy generator life. You should go to bed exhausted. This also applies for generator children, which may delay their bedtime. However, it's very healthy for them. If you have used all of your energy to the end, that's effectively turned yourself off, and you regenerate waking up in the morning full of vitality. So that comes also like, you know, you need to exercise during the day to actually run out of energy to sleep very well. Whereas there are other types of projector child, at least that's my experience, is basically you just leave them in their own space and they will fall asleep no matter whether they are completely exhausted or not, because that's just the energy that they have. And it's just really helpful, because I know that my high energy children, I let them read the book or play a little bit longer, because I know once they've exhausted themselves, they will go to sleep. Projector child doesn't need that.
Yeah, and that's, I think that practice can start during the day, like even earlier.
Okay.
Right? So because what that means, like generators want to exhaust themselves before they actually go to bed, because so that they can just fall in sleep instantly.
Mm-hmm.
That means they have to have achieved a lot of things to have, you know, created the serotonin in the system that turns into melatonin. So if they haven't accomplished enough, if they haven't had that sensation of like, no matter what it is, I've done my work, then okay, I can go to bed because tomorrow is another day.
So it's also a mental thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Approaching to that and just like, I can't hold back. Like, I just got to go full force with the energy that I have for the day. That is, I think, the approach for generators to take during the course of the day.
Yeah.
Whereas projectors, as we are saying, like, yeah, they can go to bed earlier than they feel tired, but then if they're constantly extending themselves to be a part of the generator dynamic, then that just drains them anyway.
Yeah.
So that's that connects back to the awareness of projectors who can be a part of the dynamic or the activities. However, they don't do the same thing as other people do. They keep themselves to be able to recognize different things.
I wonder that if you look at statistics of chronic fatigue, you would find more projectors. I don't know. I mean, that's a very complex topic, but, you know, like, I wonder whether there's certain patterns that you can see, because this is, you know, most of the people on the world are generators.
Right.
So it's a generator world. Mm. If projectors pretend to be a generator and just work really, really hard and until they're 100% exhausted, sooner or later, I think your health will actually take a toll of this.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I guess,
Yeah.
So that's interesting. Digestion is another one, and you know quite a bit about that. And I just give you know, the audience an example of what this could look like. So you prefer to go with the flow and appreciate the fluidity of life. So in terms of digestion, structure and details are not for you. You perceive situations passively through your senses and recall key things subconsciously. So that's not eating necessarily. It's just like, how do you digest information? How do you digest the day and so on? Yeah. But since you have a passive digestion, you appreciate different food patterns daily and are not set on specific foods, consumption time, or proportion size. Fasting works really well for you, which I know it does. Do you have an example of the opposite of this? Like other people who would basically say your digestion and you know, when you talk about food, you like your pattern the same. Mm. Or like, are there some people that really like to be really structured with their food? This is the opposite of what I like. Have you come across those?
Oh, so what you described is for your
digestion, but then
you prefer not to have a structured way of eating.
Yeah,
that's interesting. Okay, so because are you on the passive side? You're I think you're is it calm or nervous? I think that was the calm eater for you.
Oh, okay, you mean in terms of digestion?
Yeah,
you prefer to flow.
But we can go to, you're right there. Okay, so it's, so can we go back?
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
So that's conscious or unconscious? That's how I look at the different sort of readings. This is set
conscious
up.
Unconscious is this. So what we talk about for the diet is the unconscious side of the body. Of
right.
The side.
Okay.
And the conscious side is the motivation and the perspective, the view. So let's say just to answer the question though,
yeah.
Let's say you said that you actually like to open up to different menu, different recipes and things like that. So that's open. But what I noticed recently about that aspect of diet is quite interesting. It's actually twisted. And I think what you said, what it was for you, for the diet, I don't know if it says it, but it was a nervous eater. It was a calm eater.
Mm.
But that's, but it doesn't say it here. It's just a touch of nervous, let's say. So this is about the diet, is it?
Yeah.
Green part still.
Yes. Yeah.
So you're the nervous eater.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some people like to be in quiet spaces when they eat. Yeah. Some people like to be social when they eat.
Yeah,
even is defined in our design, which I found fascinating. Yeah.
And that's interesting, because then if you are nervous, meaning like if you have more choices on the plate, let's say like you go to a party and buffet or something.
Mm.
If you have more selections, then you can actually choose to eat all of it.
Mm.
That puts us into a little bit of like agitated, excited state, which we can say that a little bit of nervousness, right? But the other side of this spectrum is calm eating. If we have only a set menu, as you are saying, like it's always structured, you don't have to think about that. It's just whatever is on the plate that you're familiar with, you can be comfortable with it. You can be calm when you eat. So that's, I think, a different application of this basic framework. Is the framework for the diet gives you the spectrum of, are you a nervous eater or calm eater? And then when we apply that spectrum to different things, okay, what kind of situation? And you were saying like, okay, some people like less choice or structured way of eating. And other people are more like experimental, you know, like wanting to go out and try different things.
Is this only like specifically to real food, or is it to anything you digest, including ideas, thoughts? Right. So this is crazy. Like for some people, this is probably such a stretch, but basically you can also say, well, you know, like I like to digest thoughts and ideas by actually move around. It says here, you know, you like to digest, you know, but keep moving around while eating. So, I mean, does that mean like when I listen to a lecture, I should walk? I don't know. It's it's specific.
Well, you, I think you're doing that because you're also like, you know, getting the information from your chart in your hand.
Yes.
And then just getting information from me.
You're right. And just so dynamic.
Yeah, so dynamic. So it doesn't have to be walking around, but like you can also like fiddle around while you're in the meeting, like looking at your note and then looking at your ChatGPT.
Okay.
So that's the way that works for you to absorb and integrate information.
Like, good to know. I mean, you know, I know the type of environment I create around me to work well. And yes, it's certainly like, I like to not do just one thing in one way, but you know, there's certainly a dynamic of like digesting any information or working. There's also feeling ways. So, you know, you live in a world of vibes, picking up subtle energy from places and people around you. If something is not right, you will feel it. I ignored this for many years. Due to heightened level of feeling, you may be sensitive to electromagnetic frequencies and should try to disconnect from devices at night. Spending time in nature may also be helpful for you when you try to discern how you truly feel about something. Look, I mean, the detail on this is basically that I have a good gut feeling over there. I like a place. You know, some people say like, you know, I just follow the direction of feng shui and how I set up my space. I have a strong intuition of feng shui anyway. It just seems to be in me, and I learned it once and it's now in me. Fascinating. We talked yesterday at dinner a little bit about the environment that is right and wrong for us. I found that super helpful. So my one is like artificial shores, and I always thought, oh, I have to look at a pond or I have to look at something, but you would say no, it has nothing to do with actually a shore on the ocean. It can be anything mentally that would be would classify as that, right?
So it can be it can be taken symbolically and again applied to any given situation to really come to the place with the immediate environment that you live in. So, for example, what's shore? Like, shore is like we are at the beach and you are standing in front of the water, the body of water that extends as far as you can see. And then on the horizon is over there. And you know that beyond the horizon somewhere is other land. And on other lands, beyond there, there are different cultures, different ways of living, different ways of thinking. But you are on this side, and there's a divide, there's a boundary, because the water is difficult to cross. But then you are also aware of the other side. That's the shore. And when it comes to natural or artificial shore, Let's take a moment to think about it, because artificial shore is where I think we are more open to different possibilities coming from different directions, whereas natural shore is already set. So like any of these natural limitations, restrictions apply there. But artificial shore, we can set up any rules. Just like the example of it, I think, is the avatar or the metaverse kind of place,
mm-hmm.
where you actually get to meet people from completely different places. But there's no geographical rules apply, right? Like in order for us to meet people from different places, different walks of life, we have to go through either travel. That takes time to go to the foreign countries, cross the border, that kind of thing. That's a natural shore, that's uh-huh. a natural okay. nature.
Right.
But artificial meaning, we actually have bypassed that because of the technology.
You mentioned yesterday that wearing a headset that gives you virtual reality, yeah. that's a really strong switch of an artificial shore in a sense. And so I like that switch. And that was interesting because I thought I was meant to look at it, but it's not as look, it's actually doing it. So my normal habit is that I remove myself from work even and have my separate office. I remove myself from sometimes situation and have somehow remove myself physically from places. But mm-hmm. you're saying also in the movie Avatar, you're human and then you're not because you're in an artificial sort of virtual reality and that type of thing.
Yeah. Because this shore theme is part of the sixth color. And then when we go back to the topic that we talked about for the sixth line,
mm-hmm.
The somebody on the top of the roof at the party.
Yeah.
There's a connection to that. There's a thread running through all these different thematic across the structure.
Mm-hmm.
So it only goes up from the first line to the sixth line. And then from first color to the sixth color. And so that's the same structure. So when we start to integrate what we talked about for the sixth line theme, which is like, somebody on the top of the roof and then role model, but this is somebody who has to embody that experience of all the different lines, like having explored and then having gone through different experiences and maybe going through trial and error, then have come to that place where, okay, like I'm up here, but I just really have to integrate and then just really be immersed in what I know that is for me to do.
Mm-hmm.
Then when they are found on top of the roof, then they have such wisdom and such experience mm-hmm. to share and then show to people, demonstrate to people without telling them anything about it.
Right.
So, telling people things is like fifth line thing.
Uh-huh.
And then we know that, fifth line was somebody who was looking out from the second floor window. Yeah. And there's a lot of looking happening, right?
Okay, observation.
Yeah, observation and just like looking like how people are mm-hmm. reacting to your words, like if there are enough people to talk to and things like that. And that probably associates with the fifth color environment of valleys. When we go through the valleys,
it's a different environment, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
So, we have to just look up. And the fourth line too, second floor, the fourth line, but fourth color is mountains, mountaintop. You have more view because it's second line. Yeah. So different elevation.
Wonderful. And in a really practical way, people can design their lives of how they actually work. And
Yeah.
That's really cool. Mm-hmm. Look, there's something which is sort of the perspective. You have a peripheral perspective. Seeing things more broadly is a natural tendency for you. So I found that so true because I normally try to find the overall picture or the bigger context of something. Mm-hmm. If someone is really specific, I try to find the rule that applies everywhere in life, even though they just give me an example. It's like, is this how it is? So there's certainly that I have this perspective of how would this affect everyone?
Mm.
Like I can grasp a system.
Mm.
can do the details, but you know, it's much easier for me to grasp a bigger system rather than the details of it. And so hence, it benefits you to be more general when expressing yourself, as these manifestations may surprise you in a pleasant way when becoming reality. The way that we talk is really high level, not really detailed, even though we use examples. In my mind, we talk really broadly. Mm-hmm. And I feel really comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. But I know that other people are like, what do you even mean? Like, where do you talk? And I totally get that, that there are different ways to talk about that. And you can't always cater to every audience. But for me, it's helpful to talk broadly often.
Yeah. So that's the perspective aspect of that. And so again, I think it's the, you know, it's like six color, six tone. And six is, again, that's the same thematic that we've been talking about. And six is where so we talked about the relational side of more the intuitive side.
Yeah.
And the first 1, 2, 3 colors of 1, 2, 3 tones relate to the intuitive side of it. And 4, 5, 6 relate to the relational side of it. So what you're talking about in terms of, like, you know, looking at it broadly from the higher point of view is actually allowing us to see things in the relational field. How does that affect other people?
Yes.
Who are not here, but who are in my awareness?
Yeah.
And then based on my understanding and observation, how could this understanding and information affect them or help them, even in a subtle way? And we don't necessarily strategize how to help them out with this information, but by... Because, you know, six is about the embodiment.
Mm.
We don't have to tell anyone, but because of this larger framework and embodiment of whatever that this framework is, then we get to inspire people. We get to touch something in that person.
Mm.
So interestingly, the keynote for the sixth tone for this category is called touch.
Mm.
And it's interesting, like a touch is like, okay, just by touching, a healing can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But just by touching, we completely change. You know, being touched, we completely change the course of life because of that one moment in life that we feel touched.
And metaphorically, of course, you know, touched by a book, by any event, life event, whatever.
It changed the course of life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. And then, you know, personal and power, I found that interesting too, that there's so much that people read out of this and you know, the teachings around it. So for me, it's you're designed to see things in a very personal, almost selfish way. Mm-hmm. Your view may sometimes be perceived as too avant-garde, but be assured it's correct for you and you should not be distracted by what others see or do. Mm-hmm. Your distraction is the risk of measuring yourself against others or compete and getting caught up in winner and loser definition. Avoid being connected to outcomes and try to maintain your detached perspective. I give you that. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of emotional work recently, and one of the strongest and most devastating sort of like emotions that I had stored in myself is being at a playground at a kindergarten with four, one of my earliest memory. Mm-hmm. Wasn't aware I had this memory. Mm-hmm. And it just felt like I'm not like everyone else. It was just that feeling, and it was devastating for me, which is exactly don't do this, but I did, because I'm like, I can't be like that. Mm-hmm. My whole school career was basically like, I'm different. I don't fit in here. I'm not like, and then I'm a failure because I'm not perform like everyone else. I wasn't particularly good at school at all, you know? And so there was this thing of, I want to be like everyone else, but it really doesn't work because my mind just doesn't allow myself, or whatever it is, my design doesn't allow myself to merge into the masses. It's always that sense of I'm different, whether extreme or not extreme is another. But it's just good, again, like coming back to why is human design helpful there? Mm-hmm. You know, knowing that about myself, I don't beat myself up. It's like, oh, you know, I'm different. Well, that's what it would be. It's okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that was a great account of your experience, because what we start to talk about, this category of human design.
Yes.
The view and called motivation. So that's how we perceive life in that, you know, in terms of like what's happening and then how we actually connect that to our true standing, or like how we approach life, right? Like you can approach life on the, from the personal view.
Yes.
You know, what matters to you.
Yeah.
Instead of what's happening there and what seems to be going on there. And then if we see like, oh, you know, those two friends are like really, like, you know, really good buddies. And then I thought, you know, he was nice to me, but like, looks like, you know, he's even better friend with that buddy. That kind of gives us a feeling of alienation.
Yes.
However, if we can focus on the personal experience of each of the friend, we can actually come to feel that, you know, I have these many friends, and we have the quality of differences in each of these relationships. That's where that the personal view can come to in terms of the social interactions and where we stand in our life. So, but again, it's something that's interesting, I think, about life is like, unless we have gone through that polarity of experiencing being hurt, of not being able to feel that personal thing that's happening, because we are forced at one point to look at things from the more the political aspect of things, right? It's a political thing. It's like, oh, that part is like doing well, but you know, in the relationship between these interactions is not good. That's like political maneuver kind of thing. Those things was probably important in the globalization era, but now we are going back to a little bit more like local solidarity and community rebuilding. Then what matters is like what's immediate to our environment. So that's where the six lines or six themes in human design is really pointing to the time that we are going through right now.
Yeah, we haven't spoken about this actually. So there is a little bit of a bigger plan and understanding of why human design is here, which is fascinating. I actually haven't, like, so basically what I do, how I understand it, is basically there's a particular time in the 2030s. Is it 2030 something?
It's actually coming up. 2027 is the beginning of the mutation era.
And basically, the understanding is that humans will fundamentally change in terms of their circuitry and in terms of their chakras, if you like all of that. Is that correct?
Well, I don't know if that the structure of the body graph would change, because, you know, if the humans change the structure of the body, of our chakra system, that means we're going to need a different kind of map. A different kind of, you know, framework to map out our energetics. It may be so, but human design is just pointing at the change that is going to take place around that time by looking at this framework.
So what's the change to be?
So the change is specifically pointed at certain parts of the body graph that we have in our hand.
So, like, let's talk, you know, like, so I'm a generator. I have a defined, you know, sacral energy, is it? Yep. So would that change?
That's going to be the same. But you get to actually participate in this change through your design, because now we are talking about, so we talk about type based on the definition of different centers. That's what we just talked about. But then centers are defined by channels that's running between
connections. The map you can see that.
So when you see an entire channel that consists of two different gates connected, then both sides of that channel gets colored in, defined. So we never see just one center colored in. It's always more than two.
Oh, because there's a connection.
Yeah,
right.
Because there's got to be a running through channel defined.
Yeah.
So now, how many channels? Like, I think there are 36 channels or something in the body graph. But then those channels are actually now categorized into three basic circuitry.
Yeah.
And this circuitry is actually overlapping. And so one is individual circuitry. The other one is tribal circuitry.
That's strong.
And the last one is a collective circuitry.
Right.
And so that's now this different layer of the perspective where we can actually see the orientation of each of these channels. So when certain channels are defined in somebody's human design chart, we can see the orientation, the inclination of that design based on which category the definitions in that body graph belong to. And what this 2027 thing is pointing at is some parts of the tribal circuitry group is going to shift, then that's going to affect other parts of the, that's going to affect the definitions of the individual circuitry. What that means, or what, how we can start to actually reflect on the day-to-day basis, is that tribe is basically about the community where we share the resources, who we share the meal and those resources with, who we eat with, who we interact with on that level, you know, on the level where we can actually like physically together, physically share those things, the foundation of living like that. So, you know, we may not have to professionally work with the family members. We can, but we probably will be eating with them. That's a tribal reality of our life.
So this specific time in 2027 basically says we have a change in how we, our communal setup is. Is that sort of what it points to? That we behave differently with each other?
So we behave differently with each other is more on the individual preferences, right? So the tribal setup transforming is going to affect the way that we can be individuals. So we can, what's changing? Well, I think what's changing is that there's going to be more and more emphasis and acceptance of individuality in our world.
Okay.
And we see that phenomenon already happening. Mm. You know, there are different people trying to get different titles for who they are.
Mm.
And that's like diversifying so fast. But that seems like just the initial trend of people expressing or trying to express themselves in a different way than what our culture have defined ourselves.
Right.
So the collective circuitry part is the cultural, like a social norm. And that's the part that's difficult to change overnight. But we can make individual decisions about who we, how we represent ourselves and things like that. But, you know, restoration needs to accept that. That's the cultural, the collective part. Now, there's always a tribal part of it because no one on this planet, like maybe some, live alone. Like they are always dependent on other people. And maybe like at this point not, but then when they're growing up, as a toddler, as babies, we always needed somebody to feed us, educate us, nurture us. That's the tribal aspect of human life. And when we start to express our individuality and preferences and what we are looking at, like the way we eat, the way we process our information and the way we align ourselves with the right, you know, life path and motivation, those are really individual choices and individual initiation. You know, we can't follow the instructions of other people, even though those are successful examples for them. We are all unique and different. So we have to find our own path, find a way that it works for us. In order for us to like really grow up that way, we have to have certain room, a play, a household, when we are actually sharing something. Because it's easier to set a protocol among the household, like when we eat. There's a parameter, certain rules, so that it's more efficient and we can try to feed everyone. But if the way that we digest and take in food and information are individually different, how do we cater for those differences?
Right. So it will be disruption of maybe sort of the tribal way of doing things. And there's a stronger acknowledgement of like, well, this individual does it this way, that way. And I guess, yes, you're right. We are seeing that already.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's where this thing is overlapping. The tribal situations are starting to shift. So, you know, like there are no more, there's a conventional society where people always ate together, worked in the field together, and they ate the same thing. However, there are more choices for the individuals now. But and also the way that we people come together and eat and feed themselves are changing. There are different ways to work it out.
Yeah.
And that gives opportunities for individuals to explore themselves. But at the same time, we have to somehow come together, which is at the collective level.
Mm.
But what's changing or starting, what we are starting to notice at this time is how the community structure is really starting to transform.
Yeah.
And then that is going, how that is going to affect the potentials of individual development.
It's funny that I grew up in a small town and always felt like, you know, really strongly about the community. And it was a big deal for me to leave. It's a big deal to also maybe not behave exactly how they would have, you know, connected to each other. And I guess points to the same thing, like, you know, like I have a really individual way of living and it makes me feel really, really good. These tribal structures certainly didn't support me anymore. So, you know, that's certainly interesting going overseas, you know, where you have less of those confining sort of structures around you. And it, yeah, so I would probably say, you know, my parents' generation, really happy with the structure. Myself and probably even more so my kids, not so happy with the structure and going more into the individual thing, which doesn't mean that you have to be selfish, but it just means that, you know, your individual preferences might be more important and strongly felt than what the group wants. That's how I see it anyway.
Yeah. And that just, you just, I think you just recapped the features of your own design. You have the channel of community, you have the channel which is a tribal circuit. But as you're saying, that's a community. How do people set their families or communities up to be able to sustain themselves? Like specifically to share the meals, share the setup of eating. That's what the channel of community does. But you said that the way that's been conventionally done at home didn't really work for you. So you went out and did that. Through your individual definitions, you have the channel of power and you have the channel of creative role model. So with those two individual channels or definitions mix in with the tribal channel of the community, then that kind of explains, you know, your life story.
Wow, that's interesting. That's very interesting. You know, this particular date, I mean, this is in a sense astrological, but astrological, when people hear that, they might think about planets. You could also think about parts of the universe that we are in, because we're moving through the universe in terms of our solar system. Things rotate around us, and so there's a particular place that we're in, and there are particular energies that fly through space. What are they called again in human design? Not neutrons.
Neutrinos,
which is basically sort of like the tide of energy going through that Steiner would have called ether, you know, and I'm sure ancient, you know, civilizations would have their own words for that. But I guess what I want to point out is like, we're moving, and so we are in a different, it's you know, it's a bit like you moving through space just on Earth, and sometimes you're in a tunnel, it's dark. Sometimes you are in a really sunny spot, it's really sunny and warm. I take it like that if we move through space on you know, on a much bigger scale, different energies at work. And you can predict that because, you know, the solar system moves through universe in a particular way. That was understood by the person that channeled this information in the, was it 70s? End of 70s, beginning of the 80s.
80s, though.
Yeah, 80s, right. And you know, it's a crazy story. You can look at it. It's absolutely unbelievable that this person basically just perceived all this knowledge, had worked, was part of it before, perceived this knowledge. And this particular date came out as part of what he channeled and experienced, right, of like things changing there. But I guess from an astrological point of view, you can probably see, yes, you move into a different part of the universe or whatever. Crazy.
Really fascinating part of that story also is that he later discovered that that date that he received his transmission other people received the same thing.
Right. It matched other people who received also information intuitively somehow.
Yeah. And then probably the same transmission on the same date. However, he put it together as a human design system because he had the background in his studies of mysticism and his own journey, and he had actually extensively studied I Ching by that time, which he used as a framework to anchor down the information, this vast information that he received. And supposedly other people who actually also had transmission on the same day went mad because they could not process that massive energy. So that's interesting, like, you know, believe it or not, but or leave it or take it. But it's interesting to see, like, okay, human design has such applications, and it's like, it's very coherent. That's what I is always fascinated by, is like, it takes different aspects, like a linear aspect of it and the cyclical aspect of it together. Of course, both of those are something that we all experience in our life. And, so far, using I Ching and astrology and all these traditions that humans have cultivated over centuries and over generations, those are the systems combined together. We can actually facilitate the essence or the message of this transmission. So still, that kind of goes back to our discussion about the 64 and how is it possible that we can trust something like this? Well, we've been practicing astrology and I Ching for many, many generations, and that's something that seems to have captured the essence of human life experience.
Yeah.
Now, if we drop that massive transmission into that framework, there's a interface that we can have to access that meaning. So we just have to use it. We just have to, like, you know, it's just like we're using the laptop, the computer, or AI nowadays to just really, it's as an interface. And the more we use it, the more we actually get into the next level application of that.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Hey, this was a really interesting conversation. We went really, really deep. I have so many more questions, and, you know, maybe for another visit, you know, it would be great to say, like, you know, who actually dropped this information to us, or was it ourselves that we sort of like birthed that ourselves? But somehow, it's fascinating. So, Koda, I'm really, really grateful for you spending the time of going really, really deep of what you have learned over so many years. And it will never be done because you are that investigator aligned in human design, which seems you will just keep going of studying, right?
Yeah, I appreciate this opportunity that you provided for me to really see the directions that we can go.
Yeah, right.
And also just show up when the time is right. And just that your two full profile really fits my 5-1 profile. That's called the harmony.
Okay.
Those profiles. So, yeah, I missed my 2-4 friends.
That's very funny.
I have you here in Australia.
Yeah. We need to hang out more then. Yeah. Sounds good. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you.